Welcome to the Retail Focus Podcast, a weekly collection of news, interviews, and information from the world of retail. Here are your hosts, Trent Kling and Leighton Kling.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the first Retail Focus Podcast of October. Trent Kling alongside Leighton Kling. Coming up, we'll have interviews with a couple of tech titans, one from LogMeIn, and also Michael Klein, who's a VP at Adobe, will join us. And both of them will talk about some of the technological developments those companies are making and funneling towards retailers to make e-commerce easier. We'll also discuss some of the biggest retailers in this episode. As it turns out, we'll discuss Whole Foods and Amazon. We'll talk about Sprouts Farmers Market, and we'll talk about Walmart, all of whom have been in the news an awful lot recently. But first, you know about the perks that come with owning your own business, like financial freedom, being your own boss, and having more control of your time, but maybe you're just not sure where to start. Well, all of this could potentially be yours if you open a UPS store franchise.
The UPS Store brings 35 years of franchising experience, and they were actually just ranked the number 4 top franchise to own by Entrepreneur Magazine's 2017 Franchise 500 list. They bring that stability you can rely on, the support and reputation of a world-renowned brand, and a proven business model with all the training and marketing support you'll need to make your dreams come true. Stores are available in both small and large markets across the country, and their franchising experts will help you find a location that's just right for you.
Plus, there's financing for those who qualify and special programs for military veterans. The time to promote yourself to business owner, if you haven't done so already, is now. Visit theupsstorefranchising.com/focus to get started today. That's theupsstorefranchising.com/focus. Well, we lead today's show with Walmart. They've made yet another acquisition that showcases the company's renewed direction to meet customers anywhere and everywhere and do so in a timely fashion. Instead of buying another e-commerce business this time, though, Walmart spending money on a startup delivery company and trying to reach more people in the densely populated New York City area, Walmart has officially bought the company, aptly named Parcel. Parcel is based more specifically in Brooklyn. They were founded in 2013. They're unique in that they've only been servicing the New York City area but have mastered the nuances of all the boroughs, it seems. Obviously, there is traffic, tightly secured buildings, tons of overlapping addresses in New York, and Parcel has worked to simplify their processes through continuous improvement that included keeping notes of all service entries and photos of the buildings where they have delivered. This is likely the trove of information Walmart is really wanting as they acquire this company, as they were planning to have express delivery in New York with their groceries in the near future. Parcel founder and CEO Jesse Kaplan said in an interview that New York City is a very unique market. It's a complicated market as well, and mastering that market is fairly rare, but it's something they've been able to take on. That's why Walmart likes this deal, no doubt. And for Walmart, too, they don't have a lot of penetration into New York City, at least not as much as other general merchandise retailers do. They had an app as well, Parcel did, with real-time push notifications, which was praised. But this is nothing new given the current landscape, as many of these startups and many of these delivery companies do have these type of apps. Leighton, let's get into the nitty-gritty of this acquisition. Talk about the valuation and what it means for Walmart going forward.
You can really see that this is valuable for Walmart, as they've been talking about the New York City market for quite some time. So Parcel was just going to be a natural progression here if they were to actually come through on same-day delivery. Obviously, Trent, you touched on the nuances of being in New York City, a city that I haven't been in, but I've watched those documentaries, and you could see just how busy and hustle, bustle that type of atmosphere is. And to be able to acquire a same-day delivery service such as Parcel that has been around for several years, has that treasure trove of information, is extremely valuable. It's almost so valuable you can't put a valuation on it. However, according to Recode, there is a sale price. It was just under $10 million, which seems like a small amount for a company that does same-day delivery just within the confines of New York City. However, the company has reportedly raised already $2 million, and it's unclear as to what valuation. So either Walmart got a really good deal, or they got a deal that was a little bit overvalued compared to what they had brought in previously, and according to those evaluations. Their partnerships with all major delivery companies were probably also not too valuable to Walmart, considering Walmart has partnerships around the United States with different delivery companies, and plus they've been experimenting with other same-day delivery companies as well. If we compare to some of the larger acquisitions, those acquisitions that are more e-commerce focused that we've talked about in the past, Jet.com was $3.3 billion, of course, $300 million in shares there, and $3 billion in cash, and Bonobos was around $310 million. So this is really a drop in the bucket for Walmart. Walmart, again, not in terms of net margins, but overall net income, they're extremely profitable as a lump sum on an annualized basis. This is nothing for them. They could buy a million parcels if they really wanted to. And if you look at the now what of this equation, this is, of course, the question that a lot of media outlets have covered. What is going to happen with the company's employees? What's going to happen with the founder that Trent quoted? Well, according to all the initial reports from both companies, every single person will stay aboard, including those part-time delivery drivers. And to be honest, this is probably the most important part of this story and this acquisition, because overall, the parcel employees, they're going to know the best practices, the quickest routes, the quickest ways of delivery, and all of that networking combined. And so it would behoove Walmart to keep those, even those part-time employees, a part of the company, a part of the payroll. Those are very valuable assets, and it's a really good thing. It's a good sign in terms of how Walmart is navigating all these acquisitions to keep the founder aboard as well. Obviously, this is something we've seen with Mark Lohr, the Jet.com founder, a much larger scale, a much more expensive employee, if you will. But this type of methodology, this is what's going to make Walmart win, because Trent, as we saw in Los Angeles, California, it's an extremely dense atmosphere. New York City is exactly the same. You have to get with somebody who knows that market intimately in order to be successful.
And this is something we've talked about in the past in regards to Walmart. If this is the first time that you're listening to the podcast out there, we've discussed at length some of these Walmart acquisitions of recent vintage. And they all have one thing in common. They suggest that Walmart wants to vertically integrate all of these services rather than outsourcing many of these services where and when they can. But here's the key. They don't want to have to develop these type of technologies in-house. Rather, they are purchasing companies that already have technologies, already have systems and logistics in place to complete these various tasks. So whether it's getting into higher end fashion, like what you have with Bonobos, or whether it's getting into delivery systems in a highly populated metro area, like what we have here with Parcel, Walmart is bullish on acquiring companies without spending all of that research and development money to do so in-house. And you could make the argument that long-term, it will be cheaper for Walmart to continue with these acquisitions. And also, when you're vertically integrating, you don't have to worry all that much about antitrust issues, because again, it's not as though Walmart is a direct competitor with Parcel. Rather, Parcel just adds to Walmart's portfolio of brands that can help them do their existing job in a better and more efficient way. So going forward, I would expect to see even 2 to 3 more acquisitions from Walmart in the next 12 months, trying to push further into true omnichannel, trying to push further into these last mile services that we've already seen them trying to work through in terms of pilot markets and the like. I would guess that with Walmart, what they're trying to do is certainly build out their platform here rather than trying to build from within. They've talked about a number of initiatives from within that to this point haven't grown to fruition. It was mentioned a couple of weeks ago about a grocery delivery service where Walmart employees could actually place something into a refrigerator. It was mentioned also that Walmart employees could be delivering on their way home. I think those stories are far more for media recognition and to try and get press, similar to Amazon's stories about drone delivery and Amazon Go and all of those different things. I think a lot of stories from these two retail giants are there to capture headlines. The acquisitions that Walmart is making, this is actually for internal optimization. That's what this is about. This isn't about gaining headlines at all. It's a drop in the bucket, as Leighton mentioned, for Walmart. And I would expect to see a few more acquisitions like this before Mark Lohr is kind of done acquiring external companies and bringing them in-house.
Well, speaking of acquisitions, Office Depot has bought IT services and products company CompuCom for roughly $1 billion. This will include the company's shares and the assumption of company debt. Office Depot and Staples have been trying to convince their shareholders and us, if we're to be honest, that they can rapidly change to be not only more omnichannel in their approach to the market, but also follow through on the more hands-on services that a company like Amazon currently does not do so well. This is, from our perspective at least, a more perfect fit for Office Depot and CompuCom. CompuCom reportedly has over 5 million users, 5.1 to be exact, either in terms of software, hardware, or IT services. They were founded a long time ago in 1987, and they're now owned by private equity firm Thomas H. Lee Partners. CompuCom has a massive 6,000-person workforce that addresses IT issues on site or remotely, and this is something that really is becoming a larger industry because of all the cloud computing that is going on, particularly in retail. When we were at shop.org, that was pretty much it. AI, cloud computing, all of it sort of blends together, and these historical legacy retailers need to get aboard, and that's exactly what Office Depot is trying to do here. This is the largest IT workforce for a single company in the United States. So that puts it in perspective for our listeners. This is a legitimate company that has over 30 years of experience in IT. And if you look at the valuations, we did our homework on this company, and you can see that the valuation went from the current level of $1 billion. And just about 10 years ago, it was actually around half that. So this company has been doing fairly well. It's probably something that Office Depot and their management has been eyeing for some time. Speaking of Office Depot management, the CEO, Jerry Smith, said that technology is the office supply of the future, and they said that it really is a significant milestone as they are able to offer a unique business services platform to their current and existing customers. You see that overall, their distribution network is massive. 1,400 distribution points was talked about, and you can see that the blending of the two should bring some synergies to the market. Office Depot predicts that there will be a significant $1.1 billion increase to the top line revenue projections, and this is over 2 years. So already you're seeing that immediately they're going to have that top line revenue increase. But I had mentioned synergies, another word for cost savings. They say that overall in the next 2 years, around $40 million in cost savings. I personally would not be surprised, given their platform, they could get actually those cost savings up to around $50 to $100 million. However, you see that cost savings in the years to come will come from more than likely the buying power of hardware and the combination of the customer networks between the two. This is going to help reduce friction in customer acquisition. Obviously, something we talk about all the time. Acquiring customers can be extremely expensive, but both companies now have increased their customer portfolios. Not all of those customers are going to be consumers of both products or services already. So bringing those customers into the fold, you get all of that additional data, and it's going to be exciting, and it could be a win-win for both companies if they execute at a high level.
Here, the companies are not only looking to combine some products and customer accounts, but Office Depot will be looking to leverage their massive store portfolio, even after all of these closings we've talked about, still a massive brick and mortar presence, to house many TechZone IT spots inside their locations. TechZone is a walk-up service center that currently has 17 locations around the country. It's wholly owned by CompuCom. Cloud, print, mobile, and security solutions, all of these services TechZone includes in-house. They help to support and guide small to mid-sized businesses through. Think of it a little bit as kind of a geek squad only for IT or office IT. In addition, they also do some personal computer cleaning and in-house networking setup. It's not just for small businesses. It appears as though the largest part of CompuCom's business is the advising, setting up of hardware, and the support thereafter. They're a one-stop for many businesses in the U.S., and that's where you're going to start seeing those synergies with Office Depot. Layton talked a lot about some of the synergies and the cost savings, but I think this deal actually has a potential to grow Office Depot's top line because CompuCom can tie a number of their services in with products at Office Depot. When it's all said and done, looks to be a few jobs lost in this transaction, but potentially a lot more gained in terms of giving back to the customers that haven't yet abandoned Office Depot. And I think long term, you could see this actually bolster the number of jobs held by employees at Office Depot or at CompuCom. What we think is particularly neat is the fact that CompuCom's parent company will actually have a stake in the game with ownership of 8% of Office Depot's outstanding shares. They'll want to see this turn into a successful venture for both companies, but certainly because now they have some skin in the game. Apparently, shareholders didn't like what they heard or saw this week. Price of shares dropped 18% on the news, which was a little bit of a head scratcher for us because we see this as a rather positive deal. And it's a positive environment now that Office Depot is trying to foster. They're going out trying to forge some of these partnerships. You see a lot more movement on the Office Depot Office Max side of things than you see on the Staples side of things with some of the partnerships that Staples has attempted to attain over the last couple of years. Not all of them have panned out. The share price for Office Depot, ticker ODP, has looked like a rugged mountain trail in the Colorado Rockies with big peaks and valleys over the last year. Shares are currently around $382, carrying a $1.98 billion market cap.
What is interesting too here is that the company has lost so much in valuation, but we'll see a projected revenue increase that I had mentioned and an EBITDA bump, according to analysts, compared to its trailing 12 months of sales. To put this in perspective, Office Depot has brought in $10.6 billion in revenue. This was the trailing 12 months through the first week of July, meaning that CompuCom's additional $1.1 billion in revenue could mean that 9.6% of the company's top line revenue this upcoming year is actually coming from CompuCom. So if you put this in perspective, this is actually a really good deal because not only is that top line revenue going to be up, that EBITDA number is going to be up almost proportionately. Obviously, that means that the company has been running with a positive net income. Again, this could be a win-win for both companies in our view. Trent, to your point, it is a head scratcher because to be honest with you, why would the valuation of Office Depot go down if they're going to see positive earnings as a result of this and a revenue increase? Obviously, revenue has been going in the opposite direction over the past few quarters. Shareholders should be happy that management is not resting on its laurels here. What else do you want the company to do? Obviously, innovating from within can be very costly and expensive, and this is a company that brings over 30 years here of IT service experience, and Office Depot, for their part, roughly 45% of their revenue comes from service division, either business to business or from individuals coming into their store needing services done on their personal computer. So, that all being said, I think this is a win-win for both companies in my view. And the key here is for management on both sides not to get lazy. This is one of the things, as you've seen with Office Depot and Staples making a lot of executive changes over the past few years. This is going to be a positive if management stays motivated and stays with that innovative mindset. I think this is going to be a win here for shareholders as well.
Coming up after this, we'll talk to Michael Klein. He's a vice president at Adobe. He'll talk about some of the new services that Adobe is beginning to roll out to retailers as Adobe looks consistently towards R&D for both e-commerce and brick-and-mortar retailers. Now, we talked about it at the top of the show or the podcast. Do you know about the perks that come from owning your own business, like financial freedom, being your own boss, having more control of your time? And in fact, it's given Leighton and I time to do this very podcast. But if you're not sure about where to start, perhaps owning a UPS store franchise is a good start point.
If you haven't started a business in your previous life, obviously one of the things that business entrepreneurs want to shy away from is risk. Well, UPS Store has that covered with over 35 years of franchising experience. They were just ranked the number 4 top franchise to own by Entrepreneur Magazine's 2017 Franchise 500 list. The UPS Store offers, of course, the support and reputation of a world-renowned brand, but also stability in their proven business model with all the training and marketing support you'll need to make your entrepreneurial dream come true. You can see the different and various Twitter feeds and social media feeds from all the UPS Store franchisees. A very successful franchisee begins with starting in either a large or small market, and stores are available in those, and their franchising experts will help you find a location that's just right.
Plus, there's financing for those who qualify and special programs for military veterans. The time to promote yourself to business owner, if you haven't done so already, is now. Visit theupsstorefranchising.com/focus to get started today. That's theupsstorefranchising.com/focus. We continue our shop.org retail interview series, and we're joined by quite possibly one of the most intriguing interviews we'll probably have either today or tomorrow, Michael Klein, who is with Adobe. And we're going to begin just in the most general way possible. Adobe, obviously, technology giant, software giant. Why exactly are you here at shop.org?
So since 2009, Adobe acquired the leading web analytics solution called Omniture. And since then, we've been building out a series of solutions for the marketer, specifically under the umbrella called the Experience Cloud. We obviously are very well known for the Creative Cloud, Photoshop, InDesign, and the Document Cloud with PDF and Sign. With the Experience Cloud, we're giving retailers a variety of solutions that help them from acquisition of the customer through conversion to retention and loyalty to being able to communicate, leverage the data and the content within the Adobe Cloud platform to personalize and deliver relevant experiences. So we're here at shop.org to meet with our best customers and network and talk about some of the new innovations and solutions we have for the retail space.
That being said, what innovations are you showcasing to those retailers here, specifically in those demos? We noticed a lot of very interesting hands-on demos that some of your associates are showcasing to those people coming up to the booth.
We're trying to always bridge the physical and the digital because we recognize that over 90% of retail still takes place in a brick-and-mortar store. We're also, though, very well known for what we're doing online, especially around desktop and mobile. What we have in our main experience, our main demonstration, is the blending of conversational commerce with what we call fluid experiences powered by experience fragments. So what that demonstration is doing is actually starting in the living room, engaging with either Google Home or Amazon Alexa or Echo to be able to start a customer journey and really being able to, at each of these moments of truth, deliver content to the consumer that is most relevant and personalized to them, whether it be on the desktop, whether it be mobile device. And then, as you saw, bridging it in, as the consumer goes into the physical location, being able to follow that consumer and deliver the same seamless personalized experience, whether it be to the point of sale device, whether it be an electronic shelf label, a kiosk, or an application that the store associate may have to work with clienteling with their best customers.
So you mentioned seamless, and that is a fascinating aspect in that you are blending both mobile and voice activated devices together and then bringing that to the brick and mortar segment. Have there been any struggles overall into that seamless integration with that customer? Any hurdles? Obviously, it's in beta mode right now, but there are some fascinating technologies out there that you guys have utilized into having that hyper-personalization, really bringing to the forefront that experience at home and bringing it to the actual physical retailer. Because as you mentioned, that's where a lot of the business still happens today.
So there certainly are, I would call them challenges more than struggles. And the biggest challenge is connecting the dots. Last year in 2016, Adobe introduced our cross-device co-op. Because we have the ability to understand across so many different verticals who's on that device, from financial services to travel to retail, we now anonymously, through third-party cookies, we now can understand who that customer is no matter where they are, as long as those retailers are in our cross-device co-op pool. It is a relatively new program. It's just gone into public this year, but we do have some very large brands that are participating, and the larger that pool becomes, the more accuracy we'll have in identifying a customer in the physical store from the digital space. So we, because of the amount of data we have, we can match at least a minimum of 50% of users in a physical location with the cross-device co-op.
Now, we've talked about this being in beta. What so far has been the general feedback you've gotten from those that are using it in beta?
It's very positive. The ability to see the consumer as a consumer and not by the channel, and really being able to optimize and personalize experiences to the person rather than I'm Michael on the mobile device or Michael on the desktop or Michael in the store, where I can get personalized experiences, but they'll be fragmented, they'll be siloed. So the ability to bring those together have been very powerful for the customers that are using those technologies today.
Now, as we wrap this up, we cover a lot of brick and mortar on our show, and we noticed here in your booth space that there are some brick and mortar innovations that you guys have here in terms of store analytics and that type of thing. Do you mind speaking to some of the new brick and mortar analytics programs or some of the new brick and mortar software programs that you've got in place?
So we're demonstrating the ability to take in data from the brick and mortar store. We also now, when you think about some of the technologies with Bluetooth low energy tracking, wayfinding, NFC, we also have the ability now to see users as they go through a physical location, understand where they are in the loyalty program and what type of purchasing behavior they have, so that we can hand to the merchant very insightful information on what are the most important highly trafficked departments, what type of customers are in your department, how is your margin running for that day, all in real time.
That's amazing stuff. Well, and Michael, we appreciate you joining us here on the podcast. Thanks for taking time out of what I know is a very busy week for you here at shop.org. It was a pleasure having you on.
Thanks for stopping by the Adobe booth.
As always, we may have a position in or against companies we discuss on the podcast. Do not invest in stocks solely on the input of the podcast hosts.
We pick up in the second portion of our news cycle on this episode with Sprouts, as they're looking forward to having more stores to distribute to in more states. The grocery retailer has laid out plans for store expansion in 2018, and it looks like they're very confident about their market position. This does not appear like a company that's preparing themselves to be bought out. The Phoenix, Arizona headquartered grocer now has roughly 281 stores in a slew of states throughout the West, Midwest, and parts of the South. They're looking to add 9 locations just in the first quarter of 2018. In total, they've laid out robust plans to open more than 30 now across many new states for all of 2018. Ellicott City, Maryland, in particular, will be a new market. Additional locations include Albuquerque and Las Cruces, New Mexico, Fayetteville, North Carolina, Green Valley, Mesa, and Tempe, Arizona, Sacramento, California, and Valrico, Florida.
This is an interesting story for both of us, Trent, and that we, like I said, in our Food Focus podcast, we're touring around the Los Angeles area when we were there for shop.org. And one of the areas in particular, one of the retail segments we were touring, was the grocery store market in the greater Los Angeles area. And you can see that Sprouts has a very significant presence there among Ralph's and others. That being said, Sprouts has decent numbers to back up their seemingly bullish growth plans for 2018. In their last earnings call, in fact, for the second quarter ended July 2nd, net sales came in at $1.2 billion. This marked a 15% increase from the same period in 2016. The same store sales metric, which we always talk about, 1.4%, and a 2-year comparable stack of 5.5%. So really good numbers there. Net income of $41 million, so the company is profitable. They have the money to reinvest. Obviously, they do have some of a debt burden, but overall, a 10% increase in net income from 2016. Earnings per share at 29 cents. That beat expectations, a 16% increase from the same period last year. And overall, they've been increasing guidance. And so if you look through the comments during this last earnings call, if you go through that transcript, you can see some things. And I wrote down some things that really stuck out to me as to why this is probably going to work out for Sprouts in terms of this short-term growth plan. Product innovation, stronger store brand, customer loyalty, and 12% gross margin increases. These are really, really solid things, because not only does this showcase that management understands the fundamentals and what customers want in the changing grocery landscape, but they're also focused on that bottom line. So not only do they have their core customer relationship in mind, they also have the shareholder in mind. And I think this is going to be a good plan, especially as you mentioned, Trent, they're entering into a lot of brand new markets here. Markets in the Midwest as well have panned out very good for the company in terms of that bottom line increase. And to be honest with you, they can manage a decent debt level given their current net income, in my opinion. This is a company that understands that the market is a little fickle when it comes to new grocery items. This is something we talk about in the Food Focus all the time. They're highlighting all natural and organic items, and this is going to be a win-win for the company. And obviously, all the promotional activity, as much as I criticize it, that drives store traffic. So I am curious to see if this bullish plan of 30 total stores in 2018 pans out for them as well as a lot of analysts think it will.
So now let's talk about Sprouts' stock, ticker SFM. They've had a dismal showing thus far in 2017. The company's shares are actually trending towards an all-time low that they experienced earlier this year in March, currently around $18.65 per share with a $2.53 billion market cap, a price-to-earnings ratio of 20. We honestly feel like the multiple would need to inch lower to be a true acquisition target in the future. We've talked in the past about Albertsons Safeway being rumored and taking Sprouts over. Other rumors popping around. Those rumors have somewhat died off recently, and now Kroger is rumored to be back in the acquisition business themselves. To put it in perspective, their price-to-earnings ratio is just 12 after all the hits from Amazon and Whole Foods is news in terms of that acquisition. Sprouts' stock, you could make an argument, they've actually been hit harder and more directly. But Kroger had a timid showing in their last earnings report where management said they'll be ending long-term guidance measures for analysts, so that helped to take their stock down a little bit more. The bottom line is for Sprouts going forward, I think this is a good thing for shareholders, certainly, that Sprouts is coming out talking about their new markets. But as I mentioned on the outset of this story, Sprouts does not look like a company that's priming themselves for a takeover or for a sell-off. Rather, they look like a company that is set to go it alone and try to differentiate themselves from Whole Foods in any way they can.
Well, keeping along with the grocery segment, we will talk about a new segment labeled Are We Overreacting? At least for this podcast, we'll discuss Whole Foods' reported increase in foot traffic thanks to the decrease and reportedly a decrease in other grocery stores. With the news story, reports surfaced late last week that Whole Foods had an increase in foot traffic, leading to many panic-driven news pieces about how Whole Foods was stealing customers from other grocers. And we ask, is this valid, Trent? And if we look at all of the data out there, it seems to be valid, at least in the short term.
So really, this segment is designed to look at the large nature of overreactions in news as a whole, not necessarily whether Leighton and I are overreacting, but just whether the retail news marketplace is overreacting. So let's look at the two studies that came out. One was via the Thesos Group, which actually studied, based on mobile devices, the number of shoppers and whether they increased or decreased at Whole Foods. Now, right after the price reduction hit, new customers increased at Whole Foods, but then buckled right after that and has since most recently, on September 16th at least, increased once again. Whereas their regular customers actually saw no spike in terms of shopping frequency after the price reduction hit. So that's one aspect of it. And then they looked at where some of these new customers are coming from, and the attribution came mostly from Walmart, Kroger, Costco, and Target. Now, the second study, this came via JP Morgan, which used satellite imaging or satellite data provided by Orbital Insight that said for the month of September, car traffic at Whole Foods stores were up 4.6%, which was their largest increase since June of 2014. Meanwhile, car traffic at Kroger was down, as a matter of fact, over 7%. Now, let's talk a little bit about what these numbers mean before determining whether we're overreacting. So we know that Whole Foods got a traffic increase from these lower prices. However, it does not appear as though, when you look at the graphs, that this traffic increase was actually sustained for larger than a month, as some of the regular customers from Whole Foods began to come in even less after the price reductions than they were coming in before the price reductions. Similarly, the number of new customers that were entering Whole Foods stores dipped back to pre-price reduction levels about 3 weeks after the price reductions hit. Now, as far as the Whole Foods new customers and where they're coming from and that type of thing, a lot of the news stories said that these customers were streaming away from Walmart, Kroger, Costco, and Target. But here's the deal. We'll talk about the traffic study here in a second. We don't know, based on this data, whether the customers are no longer spending money at Walmart, Kroger, Costco, or Target, and we don't know how much money they're spending at Whole Foods either. The study didn't track that. Rather, the study basically tracked traffic unique to Whole Foods that had not been there prior, and what's more, this study tracked what other shopping patterns these particular customers had prior to coming into Whole Foods. It does not track whether or not they weren't going to those prior retailers after starting to go to Whole Foods, or whether they actually bought anything at Whole Foods. So we're not going to be able to tell if revenues are actually down as a result of traffic increases at Whole Foods. And that's where we get into semantics. If you're taking traffic from those companies, you would see a decline at Walmart, Kroger, and Costco, but rather this study didn't find an out-and-out decline. Rather, it didn't even study whether or not there was a decline there. So you could say that Whole Foods' new customers were also customers at Walmart and Kroger, but it's rather misleading to say that you're taking customers away from those stores when we don't know exactly where those customers are spending their money. They could go into Whole Foods and walk right back out without buying anything because the new prices aren't low enough for them, and then they go back to Walmart or Kroger and purchase the same old thing. We just don't know about that. Now, satellite data, let's talk a little bit about this study. This is via JP Morgan, and again, they used Orbital Insight for this. They found that traffic numbers in store parking lots at Whole Foods was up after the price increase in September, and it was up nearly 5%, whereas traffic decreased at Kroger by 7.3%. This suggests, as the researchers noted, that Kroger's same-store sales will be down 0.8% in the third quarter, which is kind of interesting when you see a 7.3% drop in car traffic. But here's where I have an issue with this as well. Overall, it's very difficult to see from satellite images exactly how much people are spending inside the store. So it could be that maybe you're getting fewer customers there. Maybe there are certain other extenuating factors that are causing this decline in car traffic outside of Kroger stores. And also, you're not studying every Kroger store in the country. Rather, you're studying a select group of Kroger stores that may or may not be representative of the entire base. So I think we are not overreacting to Whole Foods traffic increase. I think it's great for Whole Foods, and I do think you'll see an increase in their top line revenue if Amazon chooses to break that out. However, we are overreacting, I would say, to the traffic drops at other retailers.
Well, Trent, to be honest, you highlighted most of my main points that I was going to be talking about, but if you look at Whole Foods and you see these studies, you really can take it with a grain of salt, right? Because at the end of the day, this is all relative. If we look at the same store sales for Walmart that are coming up and those increases that we've already seen over the last three quarters in their grocery segment, yes, Target's been struggling, but overall, same store sales in much of these talked about retailers have been going up. Modestly, yes. But if we were to see the results, and we'll see today from Costco, in fact, they report on Thursday as of recording this podcast, October 5th, we'll see whether or not those same store sales are stagnant. And we'll see if they even talk about grocery being in a low to mid single digit range for the upcoming year, given the progress that Whole Foods has made. To be honest with you, I think these types of articles are just more focused on clickbait. I think they're trying to take the momentum from all the previous news stories that Whole Foods and the Amazon merger had previously, all the way dating back to the rumors of that acquisition. So I think overall, it is an overreaction from not only the media, but the people surrounding retail. I think overall, you're going to see that everything's pretty constant with all the major retailers in the grocery arena. Sprouts, a retailer we just talked about, they're talking about low single digit same store sales increases for the rest of the year. So I think if Whole Foods were to really make an advance here, you would only see it if they had a bigger store footprint. Obviously, Whole Foods doesn't have as big of a store footprint as all the retailers we've talked about thus far. Therefore, again, you have to put it into context. It's relative. And not only that, if any type of promotional activity, you're going to see a surge in sales. To say that the retailer is experiencing 4-5% more in traffic on an average basis does not surprise me at all because of the headlines. Now, it's a different story as to whether Whole Foods can hang on to these customers after customers realize that not all of the products were actually reduced in price, just a minute amount of more popular goods sold. So I am curious to see if this is going to pan out. But one of the things, and this is with all of Amazon's businesses, is we probably will not see, at least for some time, the financials and the specifics of Whole Foods. So it's one thing to bring all this data to the table, but it's another to say, listen, we won't actually have an objective answer from anybody because Amazon keeps a lot of the programs in-house. They talk about AWS, but more specifically, all the businesses that they've owned or acquired over time, we literally have no information about the financials. We can only guess. And a lot of analysts are really good at having those educated guesses. But at the end of the day, the most we're probably going to hear from Amazon executives is Whole Foods is doing okay. So from all of that, we can extrapolate that, yes, Whole Foods is probably seeing an increase in traffic. They're probably still profitable. But are they taking a substantial amount of sales away from other grocers? My answer is no.
Well, we pick up where we left off in our interview series at shop.org with Dave Campbell. Now, Dave is here with us today. He's the VP of Customer Engagement, number of other things as well at LogMeIn. But he's here today mostly to talk about AI and AR in retail. And these are two emerging trends that a number of people are talking about. But I think the real question here is when we talk about AI and AR in retail, what does it actually mean for the retailer on the back end? How do these things translate to retail?
Sure. Yeah, so today we live in this unprecedented time, especially with the amount of data that's out there. And data is really a double-edged sword. So when you think about it, the amount of information that's out there about customers and the ability to leverage that data are two completely different worlds. So when it comes to AI and artificial intelligence, it's really looking at how brands can start to leverage data in intelligent ways and then being able to close the gap or close that distance between the brand and the customer experience. Because on the outside, customers are moving at the speed of light. They just have access to so much technology right now, and they can really change the landscape in terms of how consumers are doing business with a brand. So it's very difficult for a company to keep up. And that's where AI can really step in and help, in order to help answer questions in an intelligent fashion and be able to do it in a way that's very natural. And that's what we're seeking to do here at LogMeIn.
That being said, customers are really light speed in how they shop for things, how they're looking and assessing their brands. How does AI help to simplify these processes?
That's a great question. And we're just in a different world. You know, when it comes to AI, just think about being on the front line. So everything today is done either on a website or off of a mobile device, and oftentimes at the single click of a button. And so AI on the back end is giving you the ability to create a repository, a set of data that you can build off of. And it all starts with a really strong set of information or knowledge base that can allow you to leverage that and tap into the intelligence in some of these AI technologies, such as natural language processing, which basically all it means is that it understands the questions that are being asked the way that we as consumers type them. And so by applying that technology to the front line, you're effectively giving yourself a better chance for things like conversion, a better chance to retain customers, a better chance to just answer the questions that people want to ask.
Now, from the consumer perspective, what are some ways in which, you know, if I'm a consumer just going to website X or e-commerce site X, how can I tell from that part of things if a company has actually done solid things with AI? How can I tell that a company is using AI in a positive direction if I'm just like outside looking in?
So it's really easy to tell when a company is not doing it well. And we've all been there, right? You get those bad experiences. And oftentimes, a lot of the natural tendency of a consumer is to ask the question, am I speaking to a live person? Is this actually a real person? So when it comes to an intelligent use or a good use case of AI, it's that it's the marrying of art and science, right? So it's being able to blend the fact base or the knowledge base that you have and then use it in a way that seems very natural to the consumer. And that's oftentimes is a tough thing to do. The good thing is that we've come such a long way. So where we are today, if you think of the world of consumers and we're living in the world of Siri and the world of Alexa, it really is not outside the reach of a brand to apply similar technologies in a way that's natural, in a way that's easy to implement so that you can provide that realistic experience that consumers want.
Looking at some of the publicly open information through LogMeIn. Collaboration, by your current market definition, is roughly 67% of the company in terms of revenue. So talking about AI with customer engagement and then obviously identity and access management, do you see that being a bigger piece of the pie in terms of the overall company revenue? And then obviously, as far as sustaining the business, as you've seen EBITDA margins up over 35% over the past few months. But overall, though, that being said, is that collaboration aspect going to be a smaller piece of the overall company?
So customer engagement and support is a really important part of our overall business within LogMeIn. And within that market, AI is definitely a future driver for growth. I think it's something that the company is looking at across the portfolio. I can speak for our world in customer engagement and support and our products like Bold 360 or NanoRep. But being able to leverage AI as part of that customer service engagement is something that our customers are asking us for on a daily basis. And it's something that we are really excited about our recent acquisition with NanoRep in terms of being able to deliver on that, something that's being used in over 200 brands across the world today. And with the power of LogMeIn behind that, we can surely look to expand that quite well over the next couple of years.
Full disclosure, I actually used LogMeIn just earlier this morning to set programming on a radio station back in the middle of nowhere. So we're familiar with those ends of LogMeIn. Fantastic services there. I want to switch gears a little bit and talk about AR, augmented reality. That's something that's come up a lot around here. And you guys, obviously, you talk about AI being kind of on the front lines, but you guys at LogMeIn are very much on the front lines of a lot of technological developments, AR potentially being one of them in the future. Where are we at right now with augmented reality in retail or in e-commerce, and where do you think we're headed?
Yeah, so if you look at the different waves that are out there, I think AI is just starting to get to that point of a mainstream adoption. We're talking to a lot of our customers about that on a daily basis. I'd say AR is a little bit further down the road. It's something that everyone's looking towards. And brands really right now are just still at the point where they're looking at the basic building blocks of implementing things like live video. So LogMeIn, as you mentioned, we do a lot of different connectivity services, and our mission is to make the simple possible in terms of how we can connect to devices. And we do that through things like collaboration, screen sharing, also live video implementation, so that you can actually see what is on the other side of a mobile device camera if someone's streaming that to you from anywhere across the world. And I think as AI and AR start to infuse themselves, we can start to leverage these technologies in new ways. The support of things is a key area that we're looking at, where different brands in retail are going to get smart devices as part of their core portfolios. And as those devices start, or those things start to come online, that's going to create all these new types of engagements where you're going to have data that's coming off a smart thing. It could be apparel, it could be a health device, virtually anything. And organizations are going to want to start to engage with their customers in new ways. And that's where AR and augmented reality and video can really play a key role in the digital service realm in starting to look at ways to enable there. But we're just at the beginning of at that step.
Your company is recognizing AR and the increased usage among both your customers and users. But overall, GoToMeeting is a great platform. But how would you be able to differentiate going forward? Because so many other big players in the space are trying to catch on with that curve. And as you said, it's more of an international theme in that the endless possibilities are out there. But people are seeing that and investing heavily as far as capital expenditures are concerned.
Yeah, I think we get a lot of questions around this with regards to the different types of technology within our stack. And I'd say that the one thing that is consistent when it comes to customer service and the retail world, it's looking at the use case and having the use case be the right fit. Right, and where collaboration software like GoToMeeting does fantastic things for one-to-one meetings inside the organization, that's not always the same truth for what is needed on the consumer side, especially when you're trying to deal with engaging with your customers off of mobile devices and on the go in real time. So I think that's where we're really starting to look at where are the lines. And the technology will surely be leveraged across the board, but it will be the types of implementations and the types of use cases that come up from direct feedback from our customers that will really lead us down that path.
All right, Dave Campbell from LogMeIn, thanks so much for joining us today on the podcast, and enjoy the rest of shop.org, of course.
Thanks so much. Have a great day.
Well, we've reached the final segment of the Retail Focus podcast, where each Leighton and I look ahead to a story we're keeping our eye on for the next week or the next month. And we begin, as we always do, with Leighton.
I'm talking about a mall owner that has apparently rebranded. This is an article from CNBC that's talking about, obviously, the retail apocalypse and how those types of headlines have dominated the retail media landscape. But mall owner CBL and Associates Properties will actually be rebranding to fit into a new retail strategy. They're going to be trying to promote their struggling retailers more. And this is something we've actually touched on just once or twice throughout the history of this podcast, and that those malls, those larger REITs that hold these properties that are struggling, they need to be able to promote their clients in such a way that actually drives traffic and can ensure traffic levels for the long term. By doing this, they're going to be implementing online tools and other ways to promote how they have their businesses set up and to promote certain activities throughout the year. We're talking seasonal events, that type of thing. And this is important because you can't just rely on the retailers you have in your portfolio to promote themselves. If you have an indoor mall, let's say you have 400 spaces within that mall, you want to be able to be in a good relationship. It's a partnership. It's not just a lease agreement. It's a partnership. Let's be honest. You want to keep traffic up throughout the entire mall. And you can't rely on your retailers to advertise to that direct location, because more often than not, it's blanket advertising. So I think this is a great networking tool. And this is something that is going to cost a lot of money up front for this mall owner. But at the end of the day, I think this is going to be good, and it hopefully sets a precedent for other mall owners across the country.
The story I'm looking ahead to actually comes from a private company that we don't spend a lot of time talking about, but it's in a sector of retail that we've mentioned is seeing a lot of growth. In fact, it was mentioned by Chelsea Baugh of Retail Me Not just last week, in that pet sales overall are growing, and PetSmart over the last week announced the introduction of a pharmacy to their portfolio. Now, this pharmacy won't actually be in store. This will be online only, that offers ordering and autofill for prescriptions for pets, as well as over-the-counter medications and prescription pet food. And they've combined this with a home delivery service. Some of the information that PetSmart started to throw out there noted why they're making this move. And in fact, the research firm Packaged Facts mentioned that the pet medication market could be more than a $10 billion industry by 2018. We know that people are spending more money on pets. We know also that pet ownership is trending in a favorable direction in the United States. As these pets get older, they need medication. And it's interesting because we don't really talk about pet pharmaceuticals all that much, but that industry is growing just like the human pharmaceutical industry is. But I think the big change here for PetSmart is the home delivery service and some of these options to cover the last mile. When you look at e-commerce pet sites, the main thing that's holding them back is shipping. Someone's got to absorb shipping for the large, bulky items, especially if you've got a large dog. You have to have a lot of food for that dog. It's going to take up a lot of space, a lot of weight, and it will cost to ship, whether that cost of shipping is on the company or on the consumer. But PetSmart here can leverage some of their last mile services that they're developing with their huge brick and mortar base and maybe get a leg up on some of those e-commerce providers. So I like this idea with the PetSmart pharmacy. I think this is a high margin way to increase not only their consumer base, but also the connectivity with their consumers as well. The only thing I wish we could do regarding this PetSmart pharmacy is have data on it, because again, they're a privately held company. We don't see a lot of same store sales or any other data from PetSmart. But again, an excellent idea, an excellent plan. And I'm anxious to see if a retailer like Tractor Supply Company, which owns PetSense, another pet store, may end up doing the same type of thing with PetSense or with their Tractor Supply locations as a way to drive that revenue. Well, that'll do it for us here on the Retail Focus podcast. For Leighton, I'm Trent Singh. So long until next week. Once again, we thank our guests from LogMeIn and Adobe on this episode, and we'll be back with another Food Focus and another Retail Focus 1 week from now.
This has been the Retail Focus Podcast. For more, visit our website at retailfocuspodcast.com and subscribe on iTunes or Stitcher. Follow us on Twitter at Retail Podcast.